You're listening to the micro version of the Savage Lovecast at savage.love.
If you're stuck in a relationship quandary, or if you're looking for sexual harmony, well, there's nothing you can't ask on the Savage Lovecast.
They figured it out. With a pencil and a pad and a website, they figured it out. All this time, all us left-wingers, we wanted all of them, all those right-wingers, all those Trumpers, we wanted them to think that we wanted them to think that we wanted them to get vaccinated. But we only wanted them to think that because we knew that if they thought that we wanted them to get vaccinated, then they wouldn't get vaccinated, which is what we wanted all along, for them not to get vaccinated. Because if they didn't get vaccinated, if they didn't do what we were only pretending we wanted them to do, they would die. Breitbart broke the story. Editor-at-large John Nolte has a piece up on Breitbart headlined, Howard Stern proves Democrats want unvaccinated Trump voters dead. Shock jock Howard Stern, who is not a universally beloved figure on the left, Stern lit into people who were refusing to get vaccinated. I'm going to read from the transcript. Fuck them. Fuck their freedom, said Stern. I want my freedom to live. I want to get out of the house. The other thing I hate is that all these people with COVID who won't get vaccinated are in hospitals clogging them up. I'm really of a mind to say, look, if you didn't get vaccinated and you got COVID, you don't get into a hospital. Go fuck yourself. You had the cure and you wouldn't take it. Apparently, it was this rant of Stern's that caused the scales to fall from John Nolte's eyes. He could suddenly see what was really going on. And he writes at Breitbart, leftists like Stern and CNN, LOL, and Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi and Anthony Fauci are deliberately looking to manipulate Trump supporters into not getting vaccinated. And how are we doing that? Nolte explains, if I wanted to use reverse psychology to convince people not to get a life-saving vaccination, I would do exactly what Stern and the left are doing. I would bully and taunt and mock and ridicule you for not getting vaccinated, knowing the human response would be, hey, fuck you, I'm never getting vaccinated. He continues, a countless number of Trump supporters believe that they are owning the left by refusing to take a life-saving vaccine, a vaccine, by the way, that everyone on the left has taken. And it gets worse. Now the evil libs who want Trump voters dead, says Nolte, are pushing vaccine mandates. Not because we want everyone to get vaccinated and to save lives, even the lives of Trump voters. No. It's a secret double probation, triple axel, backflip, reverse psychology effort to get Republicans to dig in their heels even more and keep refusing to get vaccinated so that they'll all die. And Texas will turn blue and Beto will finally win an election and we won't have to take their guns from them because they'll all be too dead to use them. Next up, libs tell you they want trigger locks on your guns because we don't want your toddler to find his mother's gun in her purse while they're shopping at a Walmart in Idaho and blow your wife's head off, a thing that happened. But that's a lie too. We say that we want trigger locks on your guns so you won't use trigger locks on your guns and then your toddler will kill his mother and there's one less Trump voter in Idaho. And libs tell you that they support renewable energy in the hopes that you'll burn more coal. And so the cheap land we're buying up in Ohio and West Virginia from dead Trump supporters who refuse to get vaccinated will one day be valuable oceanfront property. Look, whatever it takes to get the holdouts vaccinated, I'm all for. If they need to be told that we tried to trick them into not getting vaccinated, first by begging them to get vaccinated and then by enacting vaccine mandates to compel them to get vaccinated, if they need to be told that all the begging and mandating was a trick and that the only way to really own the libs now is to get vaccinated to spite us, I'm all for it. Okay, sure. Yes, please. Whatever it takes. But let's not lose sight of what's really going on here. The lunatic MAGA rube cranker uppers on the right, the people who work at the Fox Newses and the Breitbarts, are doing the math, finally. In Nolte's case, he's literally doing the math in his piece. He looks at how tight elections are, how few votes actually decide statewide and national elections, and then looks at the thousands of people dying every day, almost all of them, 99% of them unvaccinated, and that almost all unvaccinated Americans at this point are Trump supporters. And he comes to the realization that this can't go on forever. And if it does, Texas and Florida and Idaho and Missouri are going to be bluer than the lips of unvaccinated red staters in hospitals hooked up to ventilators. What Nolte and the right are suddenly trying to do here is reverse engineer their way out of the trap they set for themselves. Their misinformation and their conspiracy theories are killing their own voters. So now, an own the libs case for getting vaccinated, a new galaxy brain conspiracy theory to replace the conspiracy theory that was getting them killed. These lying liars lied their way into this mess, and now these lying liars are trying to lie their way out of it. Sincerely, I wish them luck. All right, coming up on today's show, on the micro, lots of your Q, tons of my A, and on the micro and the magnum, Lee Cowart, author of Hurt So Good, The Science and Pleasure of Pain on Purpose, is here to talk about what hot peppers, ballet slippers, and BDSMers all have in common. And speaking of new books, my new book comes out this week, Savage Love from A to Z, a collaboration with longtime Savage Love illustrator Joe Newton. Get one wherever books are sold, or get two. All right, let's get to it. This episode of the Savage Love Cast is brought to you by Talkspace, online therapy that makes it easy to get extra mental health support. For $100 off your first month, go to Talkspace.com and use the offer code SAVAGE.
This episode of the Lovecast is brought to you by the good folks at Squarespace. They make it easy to build a beautiful website, blog, or online store. Head on over to squarespace.com/savage for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code SAVAGE to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by omgyes.com, a website devoted to women's pleasure. Check it out and get a discount when you go to omgyes.com/savage.
Hey Dan, Magnum subscriber in my late 20s, queer female here with a sex success story. I've identified as bi for quite some time now, but about this time last year, I came out as a lesbian. Not an ideal time, especially being in the middle of quarantine, and even more difficult because I had to find my way out of a long-term straight relationship. Throughout the last year, I've been on a lot of dating apps with not a lot of luck, I think due to my lack of experience with women, which seemed to be a turnoff for a lot of them, and that was really discouraging. I'm a very sexual person. So being celibate for about the last year and a half or so has been super rough. But after following some of your advice and being really transparent in my dating profiles, I finally found someone who saw past my inexperience. And I'm happy to say I just had sex with her and it felt so fucking good. It was amazing, Dan. We started making out. Things started slowly escalating, and eventually we were both naked and rolling around with our hands, exploring every inch of each other. Because it was my first time having sex with a woman, I told her to sit on my face so she could control it a little more, so I could kind of figure out where to navigate my tongue. And then I fucked her. It was awesome. She was so wet, and feeling her body contract as I was inside of her was amazing. Holy hell, I was in heaven, Dan. So a big thank you to you and Nancy and the tech-savvy at-risk youth for helping this late bloomer get laid.
Thank you so much for calling and sharing your success story, and congratulations. And I'm glad the transparency advice that you took worked for you and you found the right person who wasn't turned off by your inexperience. To anyone out there who's inexperienced and worried that that might be a turnoff, a person who's turned off by your inexperience isn't a person who's going to be patient or kind or indulgent or understanding, and you don't want to go to bed with them anyway, so don't hide it. Put it out there like the caller did. Risk making yourself vulnerable. All right. Loved that success story. If you have a good one that you want to share, give us a call. Share your sex success story, and we may open next week's Lovecast with yours.
Hey, Dan. 35-year-old cis polyam white dude from Texas. And my question is, do you think it's acceptable for me to date a white woman with dreadlocks? She is aware that many people consider it to be cultural appropriation, but obviously doesn't care. Should it be disqualifying? My partner certainly thinks so. And I know that my friends will judge me for it. I'm curious what you and your listeners think.
I don't want to be the reply guy on Twitter going off about how the ancient Greeks and Indians and Aztecs and people in the Middle East and early Christians wore dreadlocks and therefore blah, blah, blah. I am, however, not down with hair cops and telling people what they can and can't wear or can and can't do or how they can or cannot style their hair. But I have to recognize that as a white person, I don't have, if I may, skin in this game. I mean, I'm Irish. I've always been super annoyed by St. Patrick's Day parades, but it doesn't compare, right? In the history of oppression of the Irish in America, brief and no comparison. My issue with white people in dreadlocks, and maybe this is what your other partner and your friends are picking up on, is right now at this moment, to be a white person, to be a white woman with dreadlocks, you're saying really one of two things. I'm either clueless or I'm a troll. I'm either dense about how other people might perceive this and the offense it might cause, or I'm trying to cause that offense. I'm trolling. With dreadlocks at this moment, there doesn't seem to be a middle ground between clueless and trolling. And therefore, while I would never tell anybody with dreadlocks they couldn't wear dreadlocks, when I see a white person with dreadlocks, that's where my head goes. Like, wow, kind of clueless, not reading the room or the planet, or a troll. And I don't know about you, but I don't like to spend a lot of time with clueless people. People with poor judgment, I sometimes call them on the show. And I don't like to spend any time with trolls. So you're going to have to make your own best judgment here. Is this woman that you're interested in, this white woman with the dreadlocks, is she clueless or is she a troll? Maybe if you start dating her and she has conversations with your primary partner and with some other people, she might think better of it. Maybe you could call her in instead of calling her out, like they sometimes say on social media, and she will see the error of her hairdresser's ways. Or maybe not. Or maybe she occupies that middle ground, that contested middle ground, that almost impossible to see middle ground, where she is neither clueless nor a troll. And this is not cultural appropriation on her part, or not thoughtless cultural appropriation, but some sort of careful, thought out, justified cultural appreciation on her part. Or maybe it's just a fucking hairstyle that she likes and she thinks looks good on her. But if she hasn't thought about it at this moment, she needs to think about it. Maybe getting involved with all y'all who clearly have thought about it or have opinions about it might cause her to give it a little bit more thought. We all talk to our friends when we're experiencing issues, but friends don't always give us the advice we really need. And a lot of you, and I love you, you ask me for advice, but sometimes you really should be talking to an actual professional. And often that is my advice, to talk with an actual professional, because there are things that a really good therapist can do for you, get you the guidance that you need, that even the best sex advice podcast host can't. That's why I recommend to my listeners Talkspace. Talkspace app makes it easy to connect with your licensed therapist on your schedule without having to wait weeks before your next appointment. You can go anywhere, anywhere, and take your therapist with you in your pocket. Send and receive unlimited messages with your dedicated therapist in the app. Schedule live video sessions with your licensed therapist from anywhere. Whether you're a parent, a student, a millennial, or just someone having a hard day, Talkspace can provide the support to help you feel better with a single message. Match with a licensed therapist when you go to Talkspace.com and get $100 off your first month with the promo code SAVAGE. That's $100 off when you use the promo code SAVAGE at Talkspace.com.
Hey, Dan. I am a 40-year-old gay man in San Francisco, and I have recently ended up in a beautiful, loving relationship, an intergenerational relationship with this beautiful guy that's 27. He is super kinky, super into the kink scene here in San Francisco. He loves being denigrated, sort of used, treated like shit, like that. and I can't. I just love him so much. It feels like hard for me to do that. So we consider ourselves a polyamorous couple, but we act like an open couple. Like I let him go get his kink fix and he loves it and he comes back to me and we cuddle and it's all good. But over time, we're falling more and more in love. Like this feeling is getting more intense. Like it's the real deal. And I want to start to give him more of what he needs. And I wonder if you have any advice for me about how to shore up the guts to denigrate him in the way that he needs and wants so that we can develop that connection.
You know, when you don't stand in the way of your partner getting what they need, something they need, not everything they need, elsewhere, you are meeting their needs. You're allowing them to have what they need. And therefore, I think you are giving your partner what he needs. And there are a lot of kinky people out there who are into, you know, humiliation, degradation, sometimes pain, who don't want those things from their primary partner. They want different things, different kinds of sex, different kinds of lovemaking from their primary partner. And they can't tap into their primary partner in that same way that they can tap into a casual sex partner or a brand new sex partner, where they can really get into that role as, you know, the degraded cocksucking sub. And if that's the case for your partner, that's fine. And if it's the case that because you have such strong feelings for him, because you love him, that you're not able to go there, you're not able to degrade him in the way that he enjoys being degraded and might enjoy being degraded by you if there's something he wants from you, that's fine too. You don't necessarily have to go there. The thing you don't want to do is tell your partner, you know, we're in love and we're shutting this relationship down. And because I'm insecure that I can't meet this need of yours, you're not allowed to get it met elsewhere. And you have to go without. And you're not attempting to impose that on him. So I think you need to relax. And I think you need to be okay with where you're at right now with your partner. Maybe you'll grow into this, not as you begin to feel less for him, not, you know, as a marker of you falling out of love for him or being less into him. Maybe you'll grow into this and you'll catch a groove where there's some angle you can work where you're degrading him. Maybe not in the exact same way or with the exact same terminology that a casual sex partner or a new sex partner might be able to do it with him, but you'll find your slice of his, of this part of his erotic imagination, or you won't. It could also be the case that you just might want to tag along, that someone else treating him like this in front of the man who loves him might give it that layer. And then the place that you can explore is dirty talk about that, dirty talk around that, before and after that. Because imagine how degrading it would be for him to be treated that way by someone in front of you. And that may be your way in. But right now, enjoy where you're at and don't rush it. It's wonderful when people have a strong sexual connection, but the longer you're together, you want your sexual connection, you want your sexual dynamic to grow and change and evolve. And that is a process that I think requires some intentionality. It has to have some thought, some commitment, but it also has to be allowed once there's some thoughtfulness about it and some intentionality or openness to it, conscious openness to that kind of evolution of the dynamics. At that point, you have to kind of let it happen organically. You make sure that all the settings are correct, all the dials are set so that there is this opportunity for growth and this allowance for it and for shifting emotional and sexual dynamics and types of play. And then just sit back and be confident that since you've invited it, you've opened the door to it, that when it should come, if it should come, it'll come. And if it never comes, so long as you two are still connected, still in love, that the relationship is still sexual, if that's what you both want your primary loving committed relationship to be, it still is, it can be fine. And there can be nothing wrong with your relationship if this part of your boyfriend's, you know, erotic imagination, your boyfriend's needs, is a place you never visit together, is a need that you can't meet. But you're not preventing him from getting that need met elsewhere. And you are also meeting other equally as important, if not more important, needs of his. Don't devalue those.
I heard a rumor that you do not yet have a website. I didn't believe it at first because you're so together in so many other ways. But my friend, in order to succeed at your latest venture, you simply must use Squarespace. They make it easy to put together a smashing website, blog, or online store. They have everything you need. Domains, marketing tools, analytics, e-commerce. Squarespace empowers millions of creative types and entrepreneurs by providing them with the tools they need to bring their brilliant ideas to life. Squarespace can help you get your creative project or business venture off the ground. For instance, you can use Squarespace's suite of marketing tools and integrations to help drive traffic to your site and grow your brand. You'll create powerful email content that matches your website and your existing products, blog posts, and logo, so your messaging is consistent and effective. And what's more, everything you make with Squarespace translates perfectly to mobile. Head on over to squarespace.com/savage for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code SAVAGE to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/savage, and use the offer code SAVAGE.
We're going to take a quick break from your calls to speak with Lee Cowart, a researcher and journalist whose work has appeared in The Washington Post, New York Magazine, BuzzFeed, Vice, and other outlets. Before becoming a journalist, Cowart was immersed in academia, doing research on subjects like sexual dimorphism in leaf-nosed bats. Their new book, Hurts So Good, The Science and Culture of Pain on Purpose, has just been published. Hey, Lee, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
I finished the book last night and I love it. So I'm a little bit starstruck always when I have to speak to an author right after finishing and loving their book. It's easier when I finish and don't love the book. So forgive me if I gush. You open the book with a pretty intense and pretty revealing BDSM scene, your own. Mm-hmm. And then you broaden out because, as you say in the book, when you look around, you find masochism everywhere. Where? When you say masochism's everywhere, where do you mean besides a dungeon or a BDSM scene? Where is masochism?
Oh my gosh. In all the places that humans have these deliberate, consensual, aversive experiences. So hot pepper eating, polar plunges, ultra marathons, ballet, circus performers, nail biters, like the list goes on. And it's a pattern that once you start to see it, you realize that like, oh, this has been going on forever throughout history. It's not a modern thing. We've been doing this in our religions, in our rituals for fun, just because we're bored. Like, it's such a common and human thing to do.
And yet, at least when it comes to masochism and sex, everyone pretends to be confused by masochists, by sexual masochists. How could you enjoy that? Is that just sex negativity? Pain on purpose is fine if you're a mixed martial arts fighter or a ballet dancer, but add a Hitachi magic wand and a shattering orgasm or 12 and suddenly no one can understand it, or they pretend not to understand it?
Yes, yes. So, I mean, sexual masochism is really common. In the Kinsey report, they found that like half of people like to bite or be bitten during sex. Half. And I think part of this kind of pearl clutching around the word masochism comes from the fact that like the word comes from this one dude, right? Leopold Sexer Masoch, and he wrote Venus and Furs, and he was a like very hardcore pain slut, right? And his name, Masoch's name, was turned into the word for masochism. So like pain on purpose is connected to this like one dude's boner. And people are weird about that. So like it's the only word that we really throw around for this in English. And it is really connected to like Sacher Masoch and Venus and Furs and this like man who wanted to be whipped and beaten and denigrated. And it became such a specific sexual paraphilia that it really gave us this like myopic view of what it means to engage with pain on purpose. And since Americans are so squeamish about sex and so like nervous about it, it really kind of keeps us from being curious about all the other ways that pain shows up for us in our lives.
And we don't usually describe those other ways as masochism or masochistic pleasures or pursuits, even though that's what they are, because as you say, masochism is associated with this one dude's very specific and sexual boner around masochism. So somebody who, you know, really enjoys and on some level has the same kind of endorphin rush experience that a sexual masochist might have from eating hot peppers or running an ultra marathon will shy away from the term masochist because of its sexual association.
Truly, yeah. And it's interesting because masochist does get used colloquially, right? Like someone who works too much, like a grad student who's in the lab all the time. We say they're masochists, but like there's still, yeah, the connection to sex means we're a little bit squeamish about really busting the doors open on what that word really encompasses.
Your book is full of so many fascinating details, including that it might not have been called masochism except for a very specific family situation. Sakharmasak found himself. Can you share that detail? I just love that. That's what's one of the things that's so terrific about your book is all the different places it goes. But share that detail about how it could have been called something else.
Right. Well, so Masak's mom was like really powerful and like just like a strong woman. And his dad's last name was Saxer. And Masak's mom was the last of her line. And she basically like bullied her husband into a hyphenated name.
In the 1830s.
Yes. And he was like a cop. Like he was like a powerful mustachioed dude. And she bullied him into taking her name too. And that's why he was born Leopold Saxer Masak. And that's how we got masochism from his mama, which is funny because he had serious mommy issues throughout his life.
You write about the importance of ritual when it comes to this phrase that you use over and over again, pain on purpose. Mm-hmm. But there's a build. Stubbing your toe isn't a choice, but putting point shoes, you talk about having trained as a ballet dancer and danced ballet for many, many years. And that mm-hmm. involves a lot of punishing physical pain that has to be endured. So while stubbing your toe isn't a choice, putting point shoes on is. And that mm-hmm. seems to make a difference. And also the ritual and the formalities built in around those moments when we choose pain on purpose. You know, a hot pepper eating contest, not just you stumble over a hot pepper and ingest it. And that extends also to, you know, pain on purpose in sexual contexts. You know, getting up on a bondage board and letting somebody strap you down, that is a choice that you've made.
Yes.
How mm-hmm. does choice make our perceptions or experiences of pain different?
So the really neat thing about pain is that it is always 100% subjective. Like there is no way for a scientist to like scan your brain and know like definitively exactly how much pain you're expecting. The brain creates the sensation of pain fresh every time. And it's based on all of these other factors. It's not like a one-to-one stimulus to response ratio. Your brain takes into account context, emotional state, expectation, and arousal, like where you are, what you're doing, and how you think it's going to go for you. So what makes pain so interesting is that when we consent to an experience that would normally be aversive, we are creating this whole new context around what we think we're going to get out of it, what we think it might feel like. And that influences how we actually perceive the pain, how our brain makes the pain. So while if I stub my toe, I'm still just as much of a crybaby as any stranger walking down the street. When I put on my point shoes, or when I did, I knew what I was getting into. I had a framework for it. I had an expectation of value and an expectation of reward that I was going to get something out of doing that. And that totally reframes the painful experience and turns it into something that I'm in control of, which is very powerful and very fun to play with.
Lee Coert, their new book, Hurt So Good, The Science and Culture of Pain on Purpose, just been published. I just finished it last night. It is tremendous, and I recommend that everyone out there with a passing interest in masochism, which is really everyone, get this book and give it a read. Thank you so much, Lee.
Thank you so much, Dan.
Lee and I continued our conversation on the Magnum version of the show, which you can subscribe to at savage.love. Magnum Lovecast subscribers get more guests, more questions, more answers, and don't have to listen to any ads, and also get invited to a monthly online virtual hangout with me. Subscribe to the Savage Lovecast, the Magnum version, at savage.love. I hear all the time from couples who want to improve their sex lives and spice things up. Interestingly, though, even many sex-positive people seldom seek out new knowledge about their or their partner's pleasure, which is a great way to spice things up. There's a cultural myth that when we become adults, we should suddenly know, or by that point know, particularly if we're partnered, we should know by then exactly what turns us on and how we like to be touched. A myth, another myth that runs strong, that needs to be taken down, is that good lovers should already know the right moves and be telepathic about what their partner wants. So many of us believe these myths and then fall into the trap of, it's good enough, why keep experimenting, why keep learning? OMGYes.com, OhMyGodYes.com, reframes the topic in a new way by presenting us with brand new research findings that are food for thought. These are new findings backed by research, tapping into the lived experience and wisdom of thousands of people. These are lessons that none of us could have possibly known before or arrived at all on our own. OMGYes.com scientists partner with Indiana University and Yale University researchers to ask tens of thousands of people what they discover is most pleasurable for them. And then they do the work. They find the patterns and shared techniques, naming many for the first time, and they turn all that wisdom into disarmingly straightforward and honest videos, animations, and data visualizations. We've gotten 3 or 4 calls from people saying that they heard about OMGYes.com on this show and that it has really improved their sex lives. People love this service. They love the work that these researchers are doing and the way that they're presenting it at OMGYes.com. You should check it out. So, see how much there is to explore at OMGYes.com. Savage Lovecast listeners get a special discount at OMGYes.com/savage. That's OMGYes.com/savage.
Hey, Dan, Nancy, and the tech savvy at risk youth. I'm a straight guy in his early 30s, dating the most awesome woman ever. We've been together for about 14 months and we get along super well. The sex is incredible. I have literally zero complaints. I work for the government and I recently got the opportunity to do a 2-year rotation in Russia. Neither of us wants to be in a long distance relationship, and we both think it'd be a pretty cool adventure as long as we could go together. The problem though is that it's about impossible for her to get there on a tourist visa, so we'd basically need to get married in like the next 3 weeks so she could also be on a diplomatic visa. She'd also have to quit her job, but we could live off of my salary, especially given that housing is paid for. She's cool with that part of the plan and is thinking of doing an online master's degree while we're in Russia, thus leaving her even more employable when we get back. I guess our question is, what else do we need to be thinking about? We've talked about kids and neither of us wants them. We've shown each other our finances and we're both comfortable with it. And we've talked to a lawyer about getting a prenup and she assured us that it would be pretty easy and basically the same as if we're still dating. We've both dated around enough to know that this relationship is really special, but we've also dated around enough to see relationships fail after a year, so we're a little cautious. So what do you think? Is it crazy for us to get married and move to Russia, or should we go for it and say we've covered our bases and we'll deal with the fallout if we're wrong about something? We've talked with our friends and family at length, and honestly, they're more supportive than I would have guessed they'd be. So what do you think?
You want to do it. She wants to do it. Your friends, your family, all supportive of you guys doing this. And so you want to know if I think you should, it's up to me now. Like you just need the gay dude with the sex podcast to weigh in. Yeah, I think you should do it. I think you should get married. I think you should sign a prenup. I think you should be very clear with one another that you're only, and it sounds like you have been clear with one another. You're just getting married now for logistical reasons, so you can continue to date each other. And then if you decide to really very seriously get married in the future, well, then you can have a big-ass wedding. And if you want that big-ass wedding to be a consequential legal-ass wedding, well, get divorced before you have that big-ass wedding, although that would be an expense and an annoyance. Yeah, go. Sounds like an amazing opportunity for her. Sounds like an amazing adventure for you guys as a couple. And if it doesn't work out, so long as the prenups are ironclad, you guys break up in 6 months, well, then she can come home, you can get a divorce. And hopefully, even if you guys do break up, it'll be like adults breaking up. You can both look at the relationship and feel good about it. A successful STR, as I call it. So yeah, go. Of course, go. You should absolutely, positively do this. I am in complete agreement with you, her, your friends, and your family.
Hi, Dan. I'm a 27-year-old pansexual woman. My partner broke up after a year and a half of being together, as queer women tend to do. We ended up moving in together during our first year of dating, and so when things ended, they moved out, and I stayed at our place, but I ended up having to pay, you know, double the rent since we were splitting it, and have essentially gone through all of my savings since we have broken up in order to afford, you know, the rent, and am now paying back, which I'm not used to, and could maintain doing this, you know, in order to continue living by myself. But it's not really ideal. We actually decided to start talking again recently and have been talking about getting back together. We broke up for two reasons. One of the reasons was, you know, the way that they act when they get, when they're under the influence, when they're drunk, and they actually got, not violent with me, but violent with one of my friends and destroyed, you know, my property when they were super drunk one night, and so I ended things then. So that was kind of one of the main reasons why we ended things. But beneath that, we were also having issues because I always kind of questioned if I'm poly or not. Recently, I started looking back at, you know, all of my past relationships and realized that I haven't been faithful in any of them, and I think that's because I am not a monogamous person. So I've been wanting to explore that, and I, you know, brought that to my ex's attention, and they were not really on board, were open to it, but, and we realized that, you know, we just weren't on the same page, and at that point, we weren't, they weren't going to be able to accept me wanting to explore being non-monogamous, and I was ready to explore it. Fast forward to now, and they have kind of changed their viewpoint, are willing to be open. We're discussing, you know, our boundaries around what polyamory looks like for us. And another topic that we're discussing is if, you know, we do decide to get back together and have an open relationship, what do we decide to move back in together? For me, it sounds very appealing because I don't want to pay this rent by myself anymore.
There's something really important that's missing from your call, from what you tell me about your relationship with your ex. You talk about not being on the same page around monogamy and polyamory while you're in a relationship with them, but now you're on the same page. They're willing to go there. They're willing to consent to openness or polyamory, and ain't that grand. But you don't have one word to say about whether your ex has done anything about their alcohol, anger management, violent issues. Your ex drinks, gets drunk, destroys your property, assaults your friends. That's what you gotta drill down on. That's almost more important. That's actually, I'm just gonna say it, even as an advocate of non-monogamy and polyamory, way more fucking important than getting on the same page about the relationship model that you would both prefer and trying to figure out if you can hammer out a compromise, whether it's DADT or something else that makes it possible for you guys to be in a relationship, even though you had different feelings about the importance of a monogamous commitment. Your ex, who walked out on you or you threw them out, sticking you with the entirety of the rent, sounds like they have a drinking problem and a serious one. They need to do something about that. You need to make sure they've done something about that. You need to do, for your own protection, your due diligence around that. You need to have a conversation with them about whether they're still drinking, whether they've sought help, gotten therapy for their anger management problem, for their inclination toward or propensity for physical violence when they're drunk. You know, assaulting your friends when you're drunk is really, you should perceive that as a potential threat to you. Destroying your property is often the first move that someone who is capable of physically abusing you pulls. The first way they show you that they're capable of physical abuse is to abuse your things or your pets. Those are very, very serious red flags. that needs to be your focus before you contemplate getting back together with this person. And if you are going to get back together with them, don't move back in together. Don't put yourself in a situation where extricating yourself from the relationship quickly and cleanly isn't an option. Tell them, sure, if they've done something about the drinking and they've sought help for their violent tendencies, gotten help about anger management, tell them, sure, we can start dating again. But like two people who are dating, we are going to have separate apartments. And if you need a roommate to help cover the rent, go get a roommate you're not sleeping with. Somebody else can be your roommate and help cover the rent. And then in a year or two, if things are going well and your ex, who is now your current, isn't drinking, isn't beating up your friends, isn't destroying your property when they spend the night, maybe at that point you can think about signing a lease together.
Hi, Dan. You often talk about how you read a lot of erotica and the irony since you organize Hump, but you've never mentioned any particular books or authors. I'm very curious to try some erotic fiction. Can you make any recommendations?
When I first met Terry, I was a couple years into writing Savage Love, and like a lot of sex writers and sex columnists, even sex advice columnists in the early 90s, I was writing a lot about my own adventures, my own sex life. And I met this guy who I thought was pretty hot. And he told me, once he realized that I was a sex columnist, that I could have sex with him or I could write about the sex I was having, but I couldn't do both. So if I was going to have sex with him, I couldn't write about the sex that I was having. So I stopped writing about the sex that I was having. And I think I have Terry to thank for the longevity of Savage Love. It's never been about me. It's always been about my readers. It was never about my adventures. It was about their adventures. And so I never hit that point that a lot of sex writers and sex columnists hit where they start, where they kind of break faith, or the readers begin to doubt the sincerity of the sex writers or sex columnists' adventures and their adventuring because it looks like a hunt for new material, not some like authentic expression of their sexual interests or desires or journey. And I never hit that point because I just wasn't writing about me, because my then boyfriend, now husband, was interested in maintaining, at least at that time, some degree of privacy and not broadcasting to the world, you know, what we were up to, what we were doing together. And even if I just talked about what I wanted to do or what I liked doing, that was then talking about what he and I were doing. And he wasn't down with that. So this is a long answer. This long way to get to just, yeah, no, I can't tell you about the erotica I read because that's going to be telling you about my sex life. And that is, even now, even if you've seen his Instagram account, even now, not okay with my husband. So also, it wouldn't really work. There's a ton of erotica out there. Go to Amazon, their self-published erotica. There is so much, like several multitudes more, the library at Alexandra's worth of just self-published dirty stories. Do what I did. Just dig around, support some independent writers working in a marginalized space, spend a couple of bucks on books with titles that intrigue you rather than going out there and reading the ones that intrigued me. And you'll find your way to authors and genres that appeal to you. Can't jumpstart this process. Even if I told you who my favorite dirty story authors were and you started reading them, the odds that they would tap into your erotic subconscious or erotic inner life or erotic imagination the way they tapped into mine are pretty slim. So you're going to have to do the work on your own anyway, even if I gave you my list of suggested titles and authors, which, hey there, Terry, I'm not going to give you. All right, before we get to this week's batch of listener response calls, let's read some of your tweets. Why Just Because tweets, how can we not include the most important Rosario in the top three? Hashtag justice for Rosario, hashtag Savage Lovecast. Why Just Because enclosed a photo of Rosario, Karen's maid, on Will and Grace, but that was a fictional Rosario. Why Just Because? Whereas my Rosarios, St. Bartolo Rosario Longo, actress Rosario Dawson, and mobster Rosario Gambino are all actual persons who live or once lived. Angry Faggot tweets, I might get to meet Dan Savage. Got tickets to his book launch in Portland. He inspired this Twitter handle. And again, that Twitter handle is Angry Faggot also inspired my career path and so much more. Hashtag excited, hashtag savage lovecast. I will see you there, angry faggot. If anyone else wants to join us at the book launch event in Portland on October 2nd, it's a Saturday at Mississippi Studios, go to savage.love and click on events for info and tickets. Squish Proximity tweets, can we talk about Dan Savage suggesting an old Doris Day film as background viewing during an orgy on episode 777 of the Lovecast? At fake Dan Savage, you are my hero. Okay, that's all it takes to be your hero. Here are a few other recommendations for background viewing at orgies. Gay leather slasher pick Cruising with Al Pacino, the documentary, Koyaanisqatsi, and the entire first season of iCarly. And finally, a private message to Big Apple Maeve. Not going to dignify your tweet by reading it on the air. You know you broke the rules, and I know you broke the rules. And that's all that matters. All right. If you want me to read your tweet on an upcoming episode of the Savage Lovecast, be sure to include the hashtag Savage Lovecast. And we very much appreciate everyone who posts to their social media accounts about the show, helps get the word out. And now, listener response calls.
This is a response to the woman from episode 777 who found herself unexpectedly in a poly relationship. I am in a similar situation, though, as the secondary partner rather than the hinge. I have asked myself a lot of the same questions, like, is it unethical for me to want this poly relationship to work, even though poly wasn't initially the plan for the open couple I'm involved with? To me, it sounds like all three of you are willing to try this, even though there are a lot of feelings to work through and still a lot of things to figure out. I thought Dan's advice to take one day at a time and allow the relationships to try was wonderful. And I hope you all are able to sort out a poly arrangement that works for the three of you.
Hi, Dan. I'm calling in response to the caller who was calling about straight men or straight presenting men at fetish events. And I just also wanted to bring up that, like, fetish gear looks different for different people. I'm a spanking and discipline fetishist. And so for me, like, my headspace is plain clothes. Like, my thoughts are a lot like, I want to be spanked by a, you know, parental type figure, for example. And if that person was wearing leather, quote unquote, fetish gear, that would not be at all headspacey for me. And it would frankly take me out of the headspace. So I also just like to avoid being gatekeepy. I know like everything y'all are saying is true, but like for me personally and for other people I know, like fetish gear might look differently. Like where my fetish gear might look like dressing up in jeans and like a cute t-shirt or maybe footy pajamas or maybe a school uniform. And the tops I play with often are dressed in, you know, plain clothes.
This is for the guy who's about to throw his first orgy for a bunch of fish freaks. I think the perfect thing to screen on the night would be Dan's Spliff Film Festival back to back is chock full of very cool psychedelic imagery that seems like would be the perfect thing for that party.
And we're going to leave it there. Got a question for me or a comment about this week's show? There are two ways to get them to us. You can call us at 206-302-2064 to record your question, or you can use your voice memo app on your phone to record your question or your comment and email it to us at voicemail@savagelovecast.com. My new book, Savage Love from A to Z, is out now in Seattle. You can join me at an event to celebrate the publication of the book. I will be at Town Hall this Friday, September 24th at 7 p.m. with KUOW's Bill Radke to chat about the book and the past 30 years of Savage Love. The ticket includes a copy of the book, and I'll be signing them after the show. Go to savage.love/events for tickets. And Nashville, Brooklyn, and Burlington, Vermont, it is your turn to get out there and get humped. Our 2021 lineup will be playing in your cities, in theaters in your cities throughout the weekend. And don't forget, this is the final weekend to stream our Hump's Greatest Hits Volume 4 online. Go to humpfilmfest.com for tickets, streaming links, and to submit your own amateur porn film for our 2022 Hump Film Festival. Follow me on Twitter at FakeDanSavage. Follow Lee Cowart on Twitter at VoraciousBrain. Savage Lovecast is produced every week by Nancy Hartunian, and me and the tech savvy at-risk youth and Nancy will all be back at you next week for an installment of Savage Lovecast. Thanks for downloading.